When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job, or your deodorant, or your lunch, or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is one of the funniest dudes on NBA Twitter. He's also a very smart and very creative individual. He is Jason Concepcion, also known to you on Twitter as Network, with a three where the second E should be. You know Jason's work in the past, of course, from Grantland and The Ringer. He's now with Crooked Media, where he is a very busy man. He is the co-host, along with Renee Montgomery, of the Take Line Pod, which covers sports and culture. He's the host of the X-Ray Vision Podcast, which covers pop culture and entertainment, everything from Star Wars to Succession. And of course, he is the host and creator of the very funny All Caps NBA, one of my favorite things on the interwebs. Jason's won an Emmy for his work, well-earned Emmy. He's also a diehard, long-suffering Knicks fan. I know that can sound redundant. And since this is now Cam Reddish Day in New York, we'll definitely discuss his Knicks as well. Before we get to all that, a reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the YouTube version of the pod. Just search Sports Illustrated Podcasts on YouTube. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Jason Concepcion, Network, is coming up, so stick around. Now, pleased to be joined by the host of NBA All Caps, the Take Line Pod, many other things, the Emmy Award-winning, I love saying that, Emmy Award-winning Jason Concepcion. Jason, welcome, first ever Emmy winner on The Crossover.
Wow! Unbelievable. Well, I'm happy to break that barrier, and delighted to join you.
Emmy winners don't just stroll through here.
Oh, come
just
on! There's
on a
so
whim.
Many of us. It's it's not that. Here's the dirty secret. My manager and my reps will hate me saying this. It wasn't like that. It's cool, and it has been. It's a cool thing because people now take you seriously. But it's not like it wasn't. It's not like there aren't a lot of sports Emmy winners out there.
See, this is what happens when I met you. You were in New York still. Now you've been in LA for a few years. This is the LA thing, like where everybody, you could just throw a rock and hit somebody who's got an Emmy, an Oscar, or Grammy, something, right? Like you're just numb to it all. You're just surrounded by people with shiny. They're just walking around with them on the beach, aren't they?
I mean, I do know a lot of people with Emmys, but a sports Emmy in particular, you know, it's, I am very proud of it. It's one of the coolest things that's ever happened. In the firmament of awards, I think fairly, the sports Emmy is towards the lower end of your Grammys, your Oscars, your TV Emmys, your daytime Emmys, etc. That's all I'll say. I'm proud of it.
It's way bigger than if you'd gotten something like a daytime Emmy for like a guest appearance on General Hospital or something. Is that show
still
on?
That would be cool, though.
I will note for the listeners, and people could see this if they watch NBA All Caps because it's the same background. The Emmy is literally right over your head. So clearly it means something.
What a statement piece it is.
It really is. I'm more curious actually about the sword that's hanging menacingly over it. And I got to ask, as a Game of Thrones fan, is that Valyrian steel?
It is Valyrian steel. That's Oathkeeper, one of the two swords made from the Stark family sword Ice that was melted down by Tywin Lannister. One to make Widow's Wail, King Joffrey's sword, Widow's Wail! And then this one, Oathkeeper, that was given to Jaime Lannister, and then he gave it to our good friend Brienne of Tarth.
Nice. I'm so glad that that was, in fact, actual Valyrian steel, because that was just, I was making a stab at it, so to speak. But it had to be, because you are, like, you are Mr. Binge Mode Game of Thrones, which was one of my favorite things. I should go re-listen to the whole, I should go do a rewatch. I don't have time for that, though, which actually brings me to this question. And we're going to get to the Knicks and your Knicks fandom. And Cam Reddish Day. It's Cam Reddish Day in New York. Did you know
that? I love it. I'm very excited by this trade. I was, full disclosure, dubious about Cam Reddish, but now I believe that he's an all-star in the making.
This is how fandom works.
Yes.
We're going to get to NBA stuff and some Knicks stuff, but before we get to that, I do want to delve into this, because we have already swerved into nerddom, geekery.
Okay.
With our talk of Game of Thrones, like you're like a Renaissance man, Jason. Like you are
Renaissance man.
No, seriously, in our world, all right. So you are very knowledgeable on your Knicks and the NBA in general, and you do a phenomenal job with NBA all
Thank
caps.
You.
But you are like a Game of Thrones scholar. When I used to listen to Binge Mode, I would just sit there in awe of the way you could recite like chapter and verse of these family histories, these dynasties, and everything. It was incredible. But you're also a scholar on Star Wars. You did Binge Mode on Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
I asked this only semi-facetiously, but probably actually very seriously. Where do you find the freaking time to watch this much TV and movies and consume all this NBA and sound knowledgeable on all of it? Because I can't
It's gotten harder, but you know, a lot of this stuff was, you know, you're prepping during the course of your life, not understanding that you are actually prepping for something. You know, I was a fan of the A Song of Ice and Fire books for many a year. Had read them before the series started. And so I was prepping for that. I was a fan of Harry Potter. I came to that late. I came into that right before the final book. But you know, it's like I've just been, this is Star Wars. I've been a fan since I was a kid. One of my earliest, like, kid memories is, like, we had a blizzard on Long Island. I was laying in the snow pretending I was, like, seeing the ghost of Ben Kenobi, like Luke on Hoth. You know, like, I this is all stuff that I've been preparing for a while. So getting to actually, you know, incorporate it into, like, work I do has been a real gift. I'm very appreciative of it. It's been hard. It's gotten more complicated to like find time to do stuff. But when you truly like love the stuff that you get to talk about, it's obviously a lot easier.
I love the idea of young Jason Concepcion in the snow talking to Ghost Ben Kenobi while trying not to get eaten by snow monsters.
I would just lay on the snow crawling across the lawn like for hours. My grandmother was like, come in. What are you doing? Come inside. I'm like, I'm talking to Ben. You don't get it.
That's fantastic. My geekiest Star Wars thing is that, and this is much to my wife's chagrin, I have to use that phrase a lot, my box of all my Star Wars figures from when I was a kid and Star Wars trading cards and everything is like still sitting in our apartment.
It might be worth some cash, Howard. Just FYI, the secondary market popping off right now.
They were heavily played with. They were not, like, there's not like they're in the original packages. Like, you know, these things saw some action, man. I don't know.
It doesn't matter. I think, you know, like, listen, if you're holding on to them for sentimental reasons, that's wonderful. I would suggest putting them on display. Let that be part of your life. But you know, if you're looking for that lake house, somebody needs some student loans paid off, something like that, I'd explore it.
I do have to put my daughter through college at some point.
Yeah.
The original Luke Skywalker, the original Han Solo might just pay for, like, I don't know, 5 minutes of one class. So it's funny because when you work in this industry that I do, right, as a sports writer covering the NBA, when people find out, it's like, oh my God, that's like the most amazing thing. It must be so much fun. It's such a blast, whatever. This is like a dream job. And like all of our jobs that work in this area, of course, are wonderful. And we're very fortunate to be able to do them. But I look at what you do, Jason, and I think, no, you've got the dream job. Because, like, okay, people say, like, oh, you get to talk to the players. Like, this is some big privilege. Like, no, yes, I interview these people, and then I write stories about them. You get to make fun of the players and the coaches and the owners and the referees and everybody else. And you could you have a great gift for this. I would not be nearly as funny if I was trying to make a living doing this. But I think, like, this is amazing because you also get to combine as we were talking about, your pop culture knowledge, mm-hmm. your sports knowledge, everything else. I don't think this job existed when you and I kind of sort of met on Twitter 10 years ago.
It's true.
And it's because of the time we live in. Just tell me about that, because I would assume when you and I first met on Twitter 10 years ago, you could not have envisioned that this was something you could be doing for a living.
No, for sure. Not at all. Well, I think, you know, when I started to really think about whether it was possible to get a job writing about sports, at first it was just writing. You know, like, I was on Twitter making jokes about the NBA. I'm a big fan of the NBA, the Knicks in particular. I've always eagerly imbibed NBA content, whether it was, like, inside stuff with Summer Sanders or Slam Magazine or, you know, the various blogs of Blog 1 and 2.0 that appeared, the Free Darko movement, all that kind of stuff, like, I loved. And so when it seemed like writing about sports could possibly be a lane, and I was really starting to think about it more seriously, I thought to myself, you know, like, why would somebody, at first it was just like a manifestation, like, you know, of imposter syndrome. Why would anybody read me? I don't have the connections of, like, a Howard Beck or an experience, around the league, both in Los Angeles and New York. I don't, like, I'm not a newsbreaker like Woj. So, like, how can I do this? And how do I, like, unpack whatever traction I've managed to get through social media about, like, talking about this subject in the way that I do? And the thing I came to was finding whatever authentic voice this is that I have and trying to deploy that to talk about these subjects. And that means combining the other things I'm interested in to talk about subjects, you know, dropping video game references or nerdy references in a piece about the NBA, or just doing it in a more comedic way, doing it as a script, doing it as like a fantastical piece of imagination, not necessarily this, you know, here's a gamer, here's what happened, here's how many points were scored, here's the salary cap implications of this trade, here's the yada, yada, yada. There's a lot of people that do that, and they do it very, very well. So how could I come in and do something that felt more true to the way that I engaged with the league and the subject and was also fun to do? And somehow I snookered people into allowing me to do it.
You snookered Bill Simmons and Grantland into allowing you to do it.
I did. And I'm much very appreciative of them for that.
But it's funny because that was around the same time frame that, you know, you had really emerged on Twitter, and when people like me, started finding all of your funny riffs and everything else. And I don't think I've ever asked this, and I don't know this. What were you doing for a living before it became Grantland and the Ringer and NBA Desktop to All Caps? Like, this whole trajectory, like, I know, you know, the content of the last several years, but, like, what were you doing before you got to actually channel all this?
I was, just working jobs. I was working in a mailroom for a leather company, which entailed a lot of, like, shipping and receiving of orders, and then, like, pushing a cart up 9th Avenue from 28th Street to, like, 32nd Street in the leather district to pick up stuff and then bring it back. And that was my day job, the 9 to 5. And then I did, I was a waiter, a cater waiter, working for a number of catering companies in the New York area. And I would do gigs at, like, you know, Wallman Skating Rink. I had a semi-regular gig through one of those services where I would, like, do the lunch service for the execs at Lehman Brothers. May they rest in peace. RIP, R.I.P. Lehman. This was obviously pre the collapse. So stuff like that. I would do weddings. So I was just like a working, working and stuff. And then my Twitter account started to pop off.
And so it literally was like Twitter led you to Grantland. I mean, was it as
That's absolutely the case. I had never, you know, sometimes you need like an outside force to tell you you're good at something for you to realize that you're good at something. I didn't really understand. You know, I thought I was whatever. I thought of myself as like a wise ass who just kind of like yelled snarky things at people. I didn't think about it as writing per se, but as my Twitter account started to take off, I started to think, oh, maybe I am pretty good at it. I got some opportunities to freelance for Deadspin and for a website called The Classical, which is now defunct, but which was edited by Nathaniel of Friedarko fame. David Roth, the great David Roth, now of Deadspin. And that gave me a little confidence that I could write. And I had some sniffs from ESPN Digital, who at the time, the True Hoop movement, Henry Abbott's kind of like conglomeration of various blogs into like a confederation of ESPN blogs was underway. And so there was an understanding that the internet was a place that you could find voicey talent. And so I'd gotten a couple of like writing sample assignments through ESPN Digital people. So I understood that there was like a lane there, and I just kind of dove in and pursue it. But before that, before Twitter and the internet, I was never like, oh, I'm good at writing, I should do that. I didn't understand, that was not on my radar at all.
I've been doing this for like now 30 years or so. I'm still not sure if I'm good at writing.
I don't think I'm good at it at all. Yeah.
To be a writer is to constantly sit around going like, what am I doing? Why is anybody going to read this?
I like to go, sometimes I go back and I'll read something like for Grantland or something else, like a bloggy piece. And I'm just like, how did I do that? What is this? I don't remember doing this. This is good. But where did this come from? How do I do this again?
Yeah,
could I even do it again if I wanted to?
It's the whole do it again thing, yeah. Right? Because you do it and you have this moment, and occasionally you'll even have like that Michael J. Fox at the end of The Breakfast Club punching himself on the bicep, you're like, yeah, I got it, I nailed it, I nailed the essay, and then the next time it's pure panic, like, oh shit, yeah, somebody needs me to write something again.
Yeah.
So you were doing this for when you were working for The Ringer or Grantland, like Bill Simmons's whole concept for those places was okay, sports and pop culture. And I think like even initially when I remember when he first launched that, and I was like, I'm not sure I understand these things all being under one roof, until all of a sudden it didn't make sense to me until it did. Now you're at Crooked Media, which was founded by former Obama political operatives who I think started this off purely as a political media company. But you're doing a lot of the same things there. Maybe it doesn't matter anymore in the year 2022, where a media platform is just a media platform, and people are going to maybe just kind of pick and choose the stuff that they enjoy most, and it doesn't matter what the premise was for the founding. But is there any difference in doing what you do for Crooked Media than when you're, say, at The Ringer?
Well, one of the things, not really, it functionally, no. And from an approach perspective, no. And from the type of content I'm releasing, you know, no, not at all. But what I think you're getting at is, you know, one of the things the internet and social media have done, along with like lowering the barrier to entry for various spaces and various different kinds of voices that maybe wouldn't get to produce content, you know, back in the day during the print era or the cable television era, is it allows people to separate from the brand of a platform or the brand of a network, create their own kind of a brand directly to what their audience is. So I think the people who who listen to me here at Crooked and who listens to the work I did with Mallory Rubin over at Binge Mode at The Ringer and the various and NBA Desktop, which I collaborated with Jason Gallagher, who's now with working with Tommy Alter and JJ Redick. I think one of the things, you know, that people still listen to me for is an understanding that the brand isn't Crooked or The Ringer per se. It's me and the stuff that I'm interested in.
Yeah. I think that's where we are, right? Like like I say, I think the platform doesn't matter and people will find it regardless. But I will say, because you're at Crooked Media, I have friends who are not sports fans and I don't think necessarily knew your stuff specifically at The Ringer, but because they're political junkies and we're listening to other Crooked Media stuff, they've discovered you through that. And when they say, oh, you're going on Jason Concepcion's podcast. When I was on your podcast a couple of months ago, like, oh, they were all excited. They're like, do you know Jason Concepcion? And these are folks who would have never known who you were, I think, in a previous gig. So yeah, it's interesting. It is opening up other avenues, I think.
It is interesting because, like, I mean, that's the other thing is there's these, the internet era has created these, like, microverses of fame. Like, there are, you know, YouTubers with millions of subscribers that, like, probably anyone outside of their the bubble of fame have never heard of. It's, you know, similarly, there are, you know, video game streamers with really, like, broad and deep fan bases that, like, unless you're watching, like, Call of Duty Warzone streams, you're probably unaware of. So the internet has really created these, like, really these, like, fractured universes of branding and influence, outside of which very little of that content, like, penetrates into the broader consciousness.
So we are taping on a Thursday, which means tomorrow is Friday, which means NBA All Caps Day.
Yes.
And if folks don't already know NBA All Caps, you should. You can go find it on YouTube. You can find it on Jason's Twitter feed, of course. All Caps feels like more or less an extension of NBA Desktop that you're doing at the previous gig. What makes for great NBA All Caps content? How long are you sitting there the first couple days of the week mulling over? Like, are you just looking for the most absurd stuff, or is it just anything that, like, hits you in the moment, like, I need to go after this play or this guy or this ridiculousness? Because a lot of it, it's not all absurdity, but a lot of it is the NBA absurdity. And that's the stuff. And this is why I love that we have so many different kinds of NBA content now that we didn't when I first started in newspapers 100,000 years ago, which is that it's more than just the games or the players. It is also sometimes the absurdity and the oddities. And you guys do such a great job of exploiting that stuff.
It's a good question, and it's something that we think about all the time. You know, a lot of it is because it's in my voice, so a lot of it is just, like, the things that I happen to find interesting. But I guess I'll just say, like, philosophically, what we try to do each week is, like, create a show that is actually, like, informative, right? So we have this segment called Anal ASMR, which is where analysis and ASMR come together, and there we try to have, like, a substantive NBA conversation in which we hopefully talk about stats and, like, and players' fit and chemistry and all these different things that normally go on in an NBA conversation, but we do it in the genre of ASMR, which is where, you know, whispered, where we're really focusing on sounds that have, like, a kind of, like, interesting texture that hopefully creates some kind of, like, neurological frisson between the body and the mind. Go ahead and Google ASMR if you want to see what that's about. But that's, you know, the kind of thing that we're trying to do is entertain and inform at the same time. And if we can dive into the absurdity, that's always great too. But, like, in terms of, like, finding the formula, honestly, like, that's something we're trying to figure out every week, because sometimes, you know, comedy is not, like, trying to do something funny is a lot harder than just trying to talk about something in a very serious way. Because if it's not funny, then none of the rest of it falls together, and how to do that is kind of magical. But I'm very lucky to have, you know, really talented team of people helping with that, including our producer Zuri, my friend Aaron, who's helping us write. So, you know, we're delving deeper into the formula every single week. But it is like, it sometimes it can be hard to be like, okay, what's funny about this week?
I was honored and scared as hell to participate in one of the ASMR segments. That was fun. A career highlight for sure. It's one of those things in the midst of it where you're like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this?
Yes.
This is amazing. I'm cracking up inside. I'm trying to hold it together. I don't know what this is going to look like. Will people still think, am I still a serious journalist if I'm doing this? But no, it was a blast. I loved it. Thank you for having me on to do that. Where did that come from though? Like where in the world, like how does anybody even come up with the idea? You know what, guys, what we should really do is MBA analysis, but in ASMR.
I mean, it really is that, you know, it's that kind of like guiding philosophy of like, can you give real information, but do it in an entertaining way? So it's funny. I mean, there's a reason that people don't just read the Wikipedia summaries for stuff, right? Because they want to be entertained as well as be given the information. So that's what we try to do. I have always kind of thought ASMR was, it's such an interesting subgenre that is kind of broken through to the mainstream in that people seem to be aware of what it is. But if like you watch some of these videos and there's, you know, millions of views, so it's out there. And I just thought it would be a funny way to talk about the NBA, you know?
And it is, every time. How much of NBA All Caps is, if any of it, is scripted? Or are you just sitting down, you know what the topics are going to be, and you just start riffing and see where it goes?
We outline it out in terms of like how subjects will fit together, what subjects will lead to other ones. There are certain bits that are more scripted out. Last week we had a parody song based on, you know, the news being because of the disruptions of COVID and Omicron. There's been numerous players that have been signed to sometimes back-to-back 10-day contracts. Many of them have been people that have been out of the league for a while. Joe Johnson, for example, Langston Galloway, et cetera, Knicks legend Langston Galloway, Emmanuel Mudiay, and others. And so we did a parody song based on The Boys Are Back in Town. And so like stuff like that will be, oh, here's a way to talk about this. And we can do it through a parody song. So let's write the lyrics right now and see if we can get somebody to record it. So some stuff is more prepared and more written out. Other stuff is very ad-libbed as we run through the doc. But everything is thought about to some degree. And then some jokes are written.
It's a blast. I was a huge NBA Desktop fan and now a huge NBA All Caps fan.
Thank you so much.
That and Game of Zones were like the two things that would like get me through an NBA season, right? Like, cause you get into this and it gets a little too serious as you're covering the league sometimes. And like, those were the things. I miss Game of Zones terribly. So thank you for continuing with NBA All Caps. I need it.
It's here for you every Friday on YouTube. Subscribe. Please subscribe to us. 5-star ratings only. That's for podcasts. But like, you know, conceptually, you can give us a 5-star rating in your mind.
Aren't there ratings on YouTube also?
There's like thumbs up and thumbs down, but I think they're phasing some of the thumbs up, thumbs down stuff out.
In preparation for this pod, because I am a serious journalist and I needed to prepare, I made sure to at least watch through the second episode of The Book of Boba Fett. This is the dedication I bring to the table because I know you're covering this on the X-Ray Vision Pod.
Yes, we are.
Listen, I'm a little older than you, so I think my feelings about Boba Fett maybe are even more ingrained, if that's possible, than yours. How are we feeling? You're three episodes in, probably. I'm only two in, so no spoilers on this. But like, how are we feeling so far about what about Boba Fett and what we're now learning?
I'm really enjoying it. I'm liking. I think the Tuskens are an overlooked alien society, you know, indigenous race to Tatooine. We don't get to see much of them other than them, you know, mollywopping Luke in A New Hope and Anakin slaughtering them wantonly in Attack of the Clones. So it was, and there's some legends, extended universe stuff that is now non-canonical that kind of delves into their culture and different gatherings they have, how they move about on Tatooine. But I thought, like, seeing as how they were slaughtered wantonly by the soon-to-be Darth Vader, it's been great to learn more about them and what their culture is. I love the parallels to, like, making your gaffy stick. I love the parallels to the way Jedi's get their lightsaber, which is, you know, they kind of find this crystal that specific crystal, kyber crystal that calls to them, and they go to an expert who helps them craft the lightsaber. Similarly with the gaffy sticks, you know, you have a dream and you find this branch that particularly calls to you for whatever reason. You take it to an expert craftsman who helps you make the gaffy stick. There's some definite parallels with Harry Potter and the way that the wand chooses the wizard. But I've really enjoyed learning about Tusken culture. I think the emotional journey of Boba, you know, clearly he is a changed man after digesting for an unknown period of time, and the digestive juices of the Sarlacc pit has come out, has wanted to do things a little differently, live his life the way he wants to, not necessarily as a clone of another person or as a bounty hunter because his dad / brother clone was a bounty hunter. He wants to do things in his own way. And I'm all in on that. And then, you know, the addition of the Wookiee Black Chrysantin, who's first appeared in the Star Wars comics in Marvel Comics, is just really cool. That has been really fun. So I'm enjoying it. I'm in the tank for Star Wars stuff. Like, I like it. It does it like, I just want to spend time in that world. It's fun for me.
Yeah, no, I'm same, and it was with Mandalorian as well, where it's like, I don't necessarily need this to be high art. I'm just happy to be here as somebody who grew up on this stuff. By the way, I do think I still also, in that same box, have Boba Fett action figure and Tusken Raider with the stick. The sound they make is really kind of, it sounds a little painful, actually. It's like it comes from the lungs.
It really does.
I don't know if I could pull that off without hurting myself.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? What do you think of Book of Boba Fett? You like it?
No, I am. I'm enjoying it. And I will say, as a Gen Xer who came up on the Boba Fett that we knew, who we did not know at all, the reason he was so popular...
Did not know at all. Barely knew him. He said like two lines the entire movie and that's it. And then he gets thrown in the Sarlacc pit.
And we loved him, and we couldn't wait to get the Boba Fett action figure. And then I think there was, like, the bigger one. There was his ship and all this other stuff. I just had the action figure. Because, like, look, the suit on its own was cool.
He doesn't say cool.
He doesn't say much, which makes him cool, right? He's just a couple of little lines, right? And he's got a jetpack. I mean, first of all, this is just, like, jetpack alone. Jetpack is inherently cool. If you've got a jetpack, you're great. He had stuff that could fire out of his wrists, right? Like the grappling hook rope mechanism, right? There was a lot going on there. He had cool shit. It was like
he had like the lock of hair that like the braided hair that came down from his shoulder. There was all these kind of like little trophies on his armor that looked so lived in. I was watching that. This is how deep into this stuff I was watching like the History of Boba Fett featurette on Disney Plus this weekend, and they talked about like the really wanting to make the armor seem lived in, so they designed it, you know, and then painted like a lower, the kind of like bottom base level layer of the paint was like in this kind of metallic silver paint, and then they would do the kind of like army green over it, and then would scratch it up so that it would reveal the metal underneath and look like it was this like worn in battle armor. When you first see him on screen, you're like, who is that? Really made an impression on me.
Yeah. So the folks who were like, you know, maybe they came to it later, whatever, this criticism, especially when Mandalorian came out, this idea that like, oh, who cares about this little minor character? Why do people like so obsessed with or love it? Like, you just don't get it. You either grew up with this guy and the coolness of Boba Fett or you didn't. I'm thrilled to be able to learn backstory of him. And as you point out, like just so much more about Tatooine, Tusken Raiders, yeah. all this stuff. They've really mined all this stuff. I never got as deep as you did into like the, whether it was the canonical stuff or non, that there is a whole set of literature out there about those things. I didn't
There's
even know. So
There's
it's
a lot. Yeah.
This is all new for me and it's fun. I will say, because I mentioned Game of Thrones earlier, one of the great thrills as you get into these things and you podcast on these things, you love inhabiting these characters yourself. I gotta say, I miss the Jason Concepcion Littlefinger and Grandmaster Pycelle impressions. Oh. And so I thought, you know, today on Cam Reddish Day,
oh gosh,
where your guy Leon Rose pulled off this trade for Cam Reddish, can we get Littlefinger as Leon Rose making a deal for Cam Reddish? Is that too much to ask?
Oh gosh, let me see if I can reconnect with it. It's been such a long time. Oh, it's because there's very specific lines, for instance, in season two when Littlefinger takes Sansa to the Eyrie, you know, to see her aunt. Just like, pull up your hood, your hair, it's a memorable shade. So like, okay, there, I've reconnected with it now. Let me see if I could do Leon Rose. Oh, Cam Reddish, we'll give you Travis. Can I interest you in Summer League legend Kevin Knox? He's long. He's from basketball powerhouse Kentucky with all the physical tools to be a great player in the NBA. NBA Rookie of the Month. Let's not forget that. And if you need a sweetener, well, perhaps we can throw in the top 1920 protected pick. And we'll convey to you once you deliver Cam Reddish to our clutches.
Phenomenal. Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for indulging me. Yes. And chaos is a ladder seems like a phrase
chaos
that the
is
Knicks...
A ladder.
That's, yeah. That seems like a very Nixian kind of thing.
They're a normal team. Listen, if there's one thing that this in particular deal has shown, and even like the deals, whether they paid too much for certain guys or whatever, there is in the Leon Rose, William Wesley era, an overarching strategy that they are adhering to. And even now with their moves ahead of the deadline, here's one thing that it seems clear to me that the Knicks want to do under Leon Rose is they want to move. They want to get their business done early. They want to move.
Yes.
A week before the deadline, days before the deadline. They don't want to get caught up in this kind of like bidding war. They make the move that they want to make, and then they get out. And thinking of the Cam Reddish deal, it's hard not to be excited by it as a Knicks fan. You get a player with upside for a very, very low price. Clearly the Hawks feel like they have a logjam in terms of talent. And I think clearly having recently splashed some cash for John Collins and other people that they are not thinking, do we want to pay Cam Reddish, who's been of questionable fragility thus far in his NBA career, but surely has like some upside to him. Probably not, considering what we already have on the books. So like, let's move him on before we have to pay him. And then, you know, you bring in Kevin Knox, who is essentially an expiring contract. Much respect to him. Summer League legend, Knicks legend, Kevin Knox.
You're right, though. It's a very just normal kind of...
it's a normal deal.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not overshooting. Like they've made a lot of just basic, very solid, and they're not all working out, and it's fine. They're not all going to work out. It's better than trying to swing for the fences every time, which is what many past administrations have tried to do. I still think we'll get to this. I think that's still kind of lurking in the background, by the way. But but basic deals like this, like I thought this was a really great trade for them. And look, having poked around and sent out a few texts over the last few hours, certainly the league is not that high on Cam Reddish at this stage. There are some concerns about maturity and about maybe some selfish tendencies and everything. And like, okay, that's fine. That happens with young, talented players. The logjam wasn't helping him in Atlanta. Maybe he gets more run with the Knicks, or maybe Tom Thibodeau actually just like loses his mind trying to fix all those bad habits. But we'll see.
From one logjam to another, and Kemba comes back healthy, and Derrick Rose comes back, and we've got Grimes now, and RJ. I think there's a different kind of logjam here. but also a fresh start. I think you're right that there are a lot of people. Listen, every basketball team has people that need the ball. I think the Hawks very specifically have people that very specifically need the ball, and it's quite clear that they should get it. And the Knicks have a similar problem, and I think, you know, if there is, if I have notes of concern, it's one, paying Cam Reddish going, that's like down the road, but paying him. Two, fit with the other players who need the ball. I think one of the wonderful revelations about R.J. Barrett has been his willingness to pass. He's not like the most insane, greatest passer, court vision guy of all time, but he's a willing passer and moves the ball, and was not that was not the note on him coming out of college. And, you know, so there are these little notes of concern, but we're in an age of reclamation. The Andrew Wiggins project, the continuing development of R.J. Barrett. Listen, we're in a great time to be an R.J. Barrett fan right now, particularly. Yes. It's been a tough several weeks before this, but right now is good. It gives me hope that, you know, he's a young player and that there is upside there, certainly as a kind of versatile defender and that kind of like long wing who can, if he can hit his shots and if that's real, can be this kind of like switchable 3-and-D, flexible, modern NBA basketball player. I think, you know, the upside is there. I'm excited by it.
So I'm getting you on a good day because there's the Cam Reddish trade, which I think most people agree was at minimum, it was a good swing that didn't cost them anything. And at maximum, it might have been a really smart deal. Also, the Knicks are back to 500. And if we'd done this pod a couple weeks ago, I might have gotten despairing Jason Concepcion instead of like happy-go-lucky Jason Concepcion. So where are you right now on this, though? Is this a playoff team? Is this a play-in team? Is this a lottery team?
I think this is a, you know, like, first of all, the East is crazy once again. You know, from two, the second seed to the sixth is like two games. So anything can happen. But I think probably a play-in bubble, you know, a bubble playoff / play-in team is correct. I think looking back on last season, I think we were all a little, number one, the Knicks caught some people by surprise. Number two, they outperformed a lot of their advanced numbers and they just did it all season. They're, you know, the opposing teams missed a ton of three-pointers against them that were open. That played into, you know, their defensive numbers. And I think the idea coming into this season was, oh, we're a great defense. We're a solid defense. If we can just take like half a step back defensively and a full step forward offensively by acquiring guys like Kemba and Evan Fournier, then we're in great shape. But then it turned out the defense was maybe a little overinflated last season. So, you know, the basis for that kind of slipped. But I think when it all comes down, talent-wise, we're probably probably a play-in team, and that's fine.
A year ago at this time, you and I talked, almost exactly a year ago, because I was working on a story at that time about that Knicks sudden resurgence and how Knicks fans, Knicks Twitter were feeling. You and I had a fun conversation, talked to Deezus and Mero for that story, Alan Sepinwall, some other notable Knicks fans out there. And the general consensus at that time, and you felt this way too, was, you know what? This is just great. This is awesome. This is fun. Julius Randle has been great. Quickly, all this stuff. It was just the joy of having a team that was good and fun and competitive and winning. And they go on to overachieve and finish fourth. And at the time, though, I asked you and I asked the rest of Knicks fans, and I'm going to ask it again now, was it worth the trade-off? Because it was really important in the moment for the Knicks to be relevant and respectable so that players will want to come there. On the other hand, that was a pretty good draft that they then ended up missing out on the top part of by not being bad. So Cade Cunningham and Evan Mobley and Scottie Barnes and all these guys. So looking back, do you still feel the same? Like the trick, because this is the perverted thing about the NBA, right? If you have a bad team, are you rooting for more bad so that you can get the good players who make you not bad anymore? Or are you rooting to actually win and have fun? Because that was the joy of being a Knicks fan last season, was I got to see everybody like actually enjoying their team again.
I think the draft is such a crapshoot, and tanking can be so painful. In particular, when it goes on for a while, not just tanking, but losing in general. And so I think it was very important to show, for the Knicks to show, that after years of kind of real incompetence, you're not like, you're not the worst end team in the entire league for 20 years on winning percentage because like you had a bad coach or one bad draft or made one bad. It's because management, the running of the team in general over time has been foolhardy, incompetent, etc. Right? You don't suck for that long without there being a reason. So I think it was important to show that things had changed and we were, if anything, not, you know, while not swinging for the fences, just kind of like a normal middling team that is run like a normal team without any of the kind of drama. So I think it was important to do that. And I think that they made, you know, Obi Toppin has shown some punch, has shown some fight. I think they've made some good draft picks. Grimes is showing some legs. IQ is exciting every time I watch him. So I think that the draft picks they are making are showing some signs. So that's great. And I think overall, listen, the philosophy in New York has always been we're going to land that generational star because the bright lights in New York are irresistible to the stars. And we just have to package up New York as an experience and as a place to grow your brand and it'll come. Obviously, that was stupid and facile and has not worked. But doing it this way, where you're like, we're a normal team. Look how excited the Garden is for a 500 team. Look at this, right? Wouldn't you want to be part of this? Where like now booing Julius is not, that's a fly in the ointment. Let's ignore that for now. But look at how excited everybody is for a 500 team. They're bing-bonging outside the arena and going crazy, right? Wouldn't you want to be part of that? And on top of that, the people running it are normal. They're making normal moves. They're not. It's not a trash fire. No one's brother is getting minutes on the team because, for whatever strange reason, etc. And I think that is important to do. So, I'll just say this: I think it's close enough with the kind of volatility and randomness of the draft and how painful losing and tanking can be. I think, in terms of opportunity cost, I would grade it as a success, and in terms of the opportunities provided by both, probably a push. Because like, what are the odds that we're really going to get into the top three? I've seen that movie before, where the Knicks are dreaming about Zion or whoever getting in, or Steph Curry, who's been, you know, like people love to talk about how close we came to drafting Steph Curry, and then either we get a high pick in a bad draft, or we get a low pick right under like the best players because of the randomness of the draft. And so doing it this way, the Knicks can control their fate a little bit more. And it's a real strategy that they are following through in a smart, normal, non-irrational way. I think that it's been a success. Would I like agree. To have Evan Mobley? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No. Okay, like, of course, I would love to have Evan Mobley. Do I wish we picked SGA over Kevin Knox? Of course. But those are, you know, we can only control the things that are happening right now. And so I think that it's the right, they're doing the right thing. What do you think?
I think that when you live here in New York and you see the effect, it's unmistakable and you see the value of that. That's the part of me that the tiny little part of me that's still emotional and human enough to understand how fans think, because the fan inside me of any sport or anything died many, many years ago. But the basketball dork in me, the guy who covers the league, says this is not a path to anywhere because you did miss out on potentially Evan Mobley or Scottie Barnes or somebody.
Scottie Barnes or Josh Giddey or...
Yeah.
You know.
And you and I both know this, right? Like you in this league, you succeed at a high level once you get one of those players or a couple of those players to build around. And I look at the Knicks and I think, Julius Randle. It's funny because I was looking back at my notes from when we talked a year ago and you were saying, I don't know where Julius Randle's going to go from here. Is he really an all-NBA second team type player? And lo and behold, he was. And the answer now is... No, yeah, and you laughed as you said it then too. Like it was one of those things where you just don't know that this should catch lightning in a bottle, or is there something sustainable? Because sustainability is the key thing here, right? Like, having a good season and reviving the fan base and reviving respectability is all great, but you still have to have sustainability behind it. And I don't, I look at who the Knicks are right now and I'm like, I don't know where this is all leading to. And that's like, I think that's the scary part for Knicks fans, for guys who are rooting for them, is like, where, so what's next? Like, if Julius Randle's your best player, where does that lead?
Well, I'll tell you, what's next is there is no more important project for the New York Knicks, and maybe no more important project for the New York Knicks in the last 20 years than the continuing development of RJ Barrett. If he overshoots whatever ceiling we conceptually have for him, right? And I think he's already done it, you know, not in a dramatic sense, but he's already a better playmaker than expected. He's already a much more unselfish player than I expected. He's not the kind of remorseless Kobe-esque shot taker that he appeared to be. He's a basketball player, works extremely hard, plays defense. Has been extremely cold over most of this season, but has really come on with his aggressiveness over the last two games in particular, ever since he banked in that three against the Celtics. It's like there's been some kind of switches changed. And to be fair to him, there's a lot of new players who need the ball that he's had to integrate with, yada, yada, yada. That being said, I think where we go depends a lot on how good RJ Barrett can be, how much he continues to develop, because that's huge. Is he a piece? Is he the second or third best guy on a really good team, level player? If that's the case, then that changes the trajectory of this team somewhat. But I agree with you in the sense that, listen, it's like the Knicks have they have like the iceberg salad. They have the Brussels sprouts. They have the French fries. They just need that steak, you know, they need the entree, and they don't have it yet, but they have some pretty nice stuff around it. And is RJ Barrett, like, is he that beautiful salmon or steak? I don't know, but the last couple of games have me really excited about him. And again, when I look at what Golden State has managed to do with Wiggins, I think development, it's been such a weakness for the Knicks. A huge glaring black hole of an empty space. But if they can kind of figure that out now with the kind of young talent they have, IQ, Obi Toppin, Grimes, RJ, then things can really come together, and they can come together unexpectedly, kind of like all of a sudden. It's like when I look at the Grizzlies, obviously have much more talent than the Knicks. But the kind of things that they've done with, like, Desmond Bane and finding these guys that, like, are lower in the draft, but you develop them and they take on the identity of a team. That kind of stuff, I think, is where the Knicks can really move the needle outside of this kind of dream of hitting a home run with a free agent because of the vibe of New York and the specific way they've structured the deals for their players that they have, so they can move them as pieces for this potential free agent that may or may not come in the future. But I think developing these young players now, that's the thing. That's how you move the needle. That's where the potential is. That's how you raise that ceiling.
And my fear is that at some point, it's not fear, but the concern, I think that the DNA of that franchise, yes, is still there. Right. And at some point, they're going to trade them for
Mello trade part two.
Or something.
They're all going to go, something like that. Listen, it's a concern.
Wrong.
It's always a concern, right? But right now, it's a good problem to have. It's a good anxiety to have, because some of these young guys are really, really fun to watch and exciting.
I'm still trying to figure out who the iceberg lettuce is, the iceberg salad.
I think it's Obi. Maybe
who's
I don't
the
know.
Brussels sprouts? That's a dangerous one. Like, it's,
gosh.
People are very, that's very polarizing, Brussels sprouts.
I love Brussels sprouts.
Who's
I guess
the most polarizing Nick?
The most polarizing Nick right now? Probably Julius, honestly.
Julius is the Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, Julius is the Brussels sprouts. And, you know, we thought he was the steak. He threatened to be the steak. but it turns out he's the Brussels sprouts. There's nothing wrong with that. They're obviously a much better team with him on the floor, but the Hawks gave everybody a blueprint a little bit, and I think that Julius has not shown an ability to evade that particular blueprint, which is fine. You know, again, the young guys, if they continue to develop and this becomes more of a team, a five-man team, you know, than a star-based team, then I don't hate that. I'm just happy to be in the mix after so long outside of it.
Yeah, I think that's still the prevailing feeling. And by the way, I will stand for Brussels sprouts. I will defend Brussels sprouts.
I like Brussels sprouts.
They just got to be done right. If you don't like Brussels sprouts, you just still haven't had them right.
Yeah.
All right, a couple more before I get you out of here. Rank the following Knicks fan catchphrases. Bing Bong just took off. And the thing that was great about it was completely organic. It just came off a dude on the street on a video. Bing Bong, Knicks tape, or the Go New York, Go New York, Go theme. I was trying to come up with that. I couldn't find another catchphrase. I think those are the only three of the last, say, 20, 30 years.
It's Bing Bong because there's more, there's just kind of more penetration into the pop cultural consciousness. Like, it was like a real, real meme on social media for a while and continues to be with various variations. There's like there was the Christmas song version of the various Bing Bongs. I saw when Get Back, three-part Beatles documentary, Peter Jackson's Beatles documentary on Disney Plus came out. There was a woman who did all the Bing Bong catchphrases as member of the Beatles. I'm going hard. If you see this helmet out in your yard, just know I'm upstairs going hard. Bing Bong. Fuck your life. It was funny. So that continues to have legs. So I'm going to go with Bing Bong.
I think that's right. It's the most fun of all of those. Go New York, Go New York, Go is just kind of a classic theme. And Knicks tape was always kind of a weird, goofy thing that came.
Yeah, it was goofy. Yeah,
way
yeah.
after mixed tapes were actually even a thing. It was just a bad hashtag. And then lastly, as a diehard Knicks fan, mm-hmm. How much do you hate... How much do you think about, or how much do you completely ignore the fact that the Brooklyn Nets might actually win a championship? Does it matter?
I won't be thrilled if they win. I'm not happy about it. I'll be delighted to see the sparseness of the population of their championship parade should they win. That will be funny to me. I find the pumped in crowd noise to be truly undignified and pathetic. That said, I don't ever think about them. Like, I watch their games. It's fine. It doesn't bother me at all. They're this weird small market team in a big market that doesn't kind of has yet to really penetrate the kind of like sports culture of New York. I mean, at any given time, you look at the back pages and it's still New York, New York, New York, New York Knicks. So it doesn't bother me at all, but with the caveat that I no longer live in New York City, so I'm not seeing Nets jerseys just like on the street. I'm not walking by the Barclays, so it's a different vibe, but it doesn't bother me.
Yeah. I think that that's a very consistent phenomenon. And, you know, you grew up in New York and live in L.A. I spent many years in L.A. before moving to New York. The Lakers, Clippers, and Knicks-Nets dynamics are fully analogous in that Laker fans, Knicks fans, just do not give two bleeps about the other team, even if they're better. It's like, but you still don't matter. And that's the ultimate retort to everything. I see this on Twitter every day between warring factions of Knicks and Nets fans in my feed. And it's the consistent thing. The Nets fans say, well, we're better. And the Knicks fans, but we don't care. And nobody's paying attention. It's a strange thing. The small market team in big market in both the Nets and Clippers cases, that's an accurate summation. Mm-hmm. That is kind of what it is, because they don't get the same level of attention, scrutiny, hype. It's just really hard to penetrate the public consciousness because those other two teams are so long established.
Well, I think specific to the Knicks, LA is different, but, you know, New York, the sports market there is, and for as long as there have been sports leagues in New York has been extremely divided. You know, you used to have the Giants and the Dodgers and the Yankees, and now you have the Mets and the Yankees, and you have the Giants and the Jets and the Buffalo Bills for people who want to include them, and you have the Islanders and the Rangers. But there's, for decades, there was just the Knicks. So when the Knicks were good, it unified the city in a way that was really unique, that kind of didn't happen in any other kind of way. You know, like the Yankees would win a World Series, and you know, an entire borough of Queens plus a lot of Long Island would just be like, eh. And anybody that was like used to be a Giants fan or a Dodgers fan that then transitioned to the Mets was like, who cares? We don't care about it. But when the Knicks were good, it unified the city. So that's still the case, essentially. And the Nets this is not to say the Nets don't have their fans. There have been a lot of people that have come over from the Swamp days that have just, you know, transitioned their fandom. A lot of the people who live in Brooklyn who are Nets fans are the same as Clippers fans, like transplants, people who lived around the Barclays are like, oh, I go to a game for $15. I guess I'll do that. And then they become fans, you know. So it's a lot of newer sports fans, not to denigrate their love of the game. But it's just different. The Knicks have generations and generations and generations of New York sports fans, yeah, in, you know, like, who have bought in. The Nets are very new.
Yeah, and that's really what it comes down to. I keep saying, like, it's going to take, like, people of my daughter's generation who grew up here in Brooklyn, and then their kids or whatever, and then even still, who knows? Like,
it's just going to take a long time. It will just take years. Yeah. It will take a long time.
It will absolutely take a long time. I'd be remiss before we leave the subject in the podcast as well. Good buddy and colleague Chris Herring, his book on the Knicks, Blood in the Garden,
is
out. I have not had a chance to crack it yet. I don't know if you have, Jason, but the early reviews are spectacular, and Herring is awesome, so I'm sure it's great. People should go buy that as well. Do you have a two-sentence review before I let you go?
You know, it's if you are one of these people who waxes nostalgic for the days in which the players would just tee off on each other and very few people would be ejected, and you think players are too soft now.
Just described every Knicks fan.
Yeah, then pick up Chris Herring's book, because it really is like a report from another world, just like a different kind of basketball world. Some of the stuff in there that you just, it's crazy that a lot of that stuff happened. That's the team of my childhood, and now with the benefit of years behind me, I can admit that they almost ruined basketball, but it was a fun ride while it was happening.
From a distance, it was one of those things where I could see, like, that was a team that only New Yorkers could love, right? Everybody else was going to hate what they were about and what they were doing, whatever, but New Yorkers were like, for all time, that will be the model.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of these weird things about New York where I guess like the public facing image of New York is like this world beating international city, you know, stockbrokers and billionaires and real estate moguls and Donald Trump and all these people. But really, like, the way the city thinks about itself is like this gritty, you know, blue collar sanitation worker, fireman kind of city. And so, like, that team, with guys like John Starks, who was bagging groceries, and Anthony Mason, who played at, like, on every continent except Antarctica before coming to the Knicks, it really spoke to something in the heart of the New York fan. And then, you know, and they were just extremely physical. They had one guy, Patrick Ewing, who could score 20 every night. The rest of them, it was like you just wondered where the scoring was going to come from. And so the strategy was, we will keep you from scoring by hitting you in the face every time you try to score.
It's a strategy.
It is, and it was. And that was what happened, and the league let it happen for a long time.
Great stuff. Well, if people want to reminisce about or just learn about all of that for the first time, go pick up Chris Herring's book, Blood in the Garden. Check out all Jason's work, of course, Take Line, X-Ray Vision, NBA All Caps. Have I missed anything?
That's it. You got it.
That's
all.
That's it. That's just that. Jason, this has been a blast. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. I kept you a little long, but thank you for spending the time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Jason Concepcion for joining me. Thanks to our producers, Dan Bloom and Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the Sports Illustrated podcast channel on YouTube and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.